Hello and welcome to Eye on the Middle East, a weekly podcast produced by NeonTommy.com at USC Annenberg Digital News. Today is Wednesday in Los Angeles, November 2nd, 2011, and I am your host, Benjamin Gottlieb.
And I am your co-host, Arezou Rezvani. On today's program, we will be discussing Syria's deal with the Arab League and inconsistencies in U.S. policy in the region. Joining us for our discussion is author, syndicated columnist, and award-winning filmmaker Richard Reeves.
The Eye on the Middle East podcast can now be found on iTunes. Just search for Neon Tommy, Eye on the Middle East. Syria reached an agreement with an Arab League delegation Tuesday, tasked with finding a way to end months of bloodshed and start a dialogue between President Bashar al-Assad and his opponents. So Arezou, why do you think this agreement comes now?
Well, Syria is more isolated now than it has ever been, with Ben Ali having fallen in January, Mubarak having fallen in February, and Gaddafi just a couple of weeks ago. I think al-Assad has gathered that his time is pretty much nearly up. The protesters have not let up, and current UN estimates put the casualty figures at approximately 3,000, and there is little indication that demonstrations are going to stop anytime soon. It appears that al-Assad may soon have his back against the wall. But I'm curious to know, for the United States, a country that has long played a pretty big role in the region, I mean, how would you describe U.S. policy towards Syria since the protests started?
You know, I think that since the protests started, it's very difficult to quantify the U.S. response. Recently, the United States has been very, very cautious, especially with regard to the Arab talks. There was a report by the White House spokesman, Jay Carney. He said, according to the AFP yesterday, that they've seen the report with reference to the Arab League report, but they can't verify it at this point. And what that means exactly is, yes, you know, there has been some legislation, a resolution passed by the Arab League, but we're not quite sure what the effects of this resolution will be. Obviously, resolutions by international bodies are passed all the time. And as you know, Arezou, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be action.
Now, you don't think that al-Assad will continue his position, do you? Is there still pressure to have him step down?
I think, of course, there is still pressure to have him step down, but it doesn't seem like he's letting off the gas pedal anytime soon. Part of the resolution that the Syrians welcomed with open arms was that they would remove armored vehicles and tanks from some of the hotspots in Syria, mostly in the south and also around Damascus. Sure, if they say they're going to remove tanks and artillery, they might, but that doesn't mean that they won't bring them back in if there's an uprising. They feel like there's a threat to national security.
And I'm curious to know, where are these weapons coming from?
There are allegations that I saw today, a report by, I believe it was Al Jazeera, that there are ties between Iran and Syria, especially with regard to the sales of weapons. There's also indication that these are weapons that are coming in from the Russians. The Russians have had longstanding military deals with the Syrians, and so that's definitely some things that the United States are concerned about. It's also important to note the position of the White House since President Barack Obama has come into office. There have been allegations that the president has been continuing the poor policy that we saw with President George Bush. I'm not going to go as far and say that it's an extension of the neocolonialism or the neoconservative viewpoint. Arezou, how would you qualify Obama's position in the Middle East?
I unfortunately feel like his policies are very similar to President Bush's policies. I think, you know, I look back to the Cairo speech, and it seemed like he was really extending an open hand. And ever since, we've seen that his policies have kind of gone back to the policies that were put forth by the Bush administration. There's not a willingness to reengage with Iran anymore. There have been inconsistencies with policies towards the Middle East and North Africa region. And this might be because we are approaching an election year and he needs to, you know, have policies that are a little bit more centrist.
Yeah. You know, I even think his policies have been centrist since he stepped into office. Maybe after he did give that Cairo speech. I think that was 2009.
2009.
He did give that speech, and it's considered one of his best speeches that he's given.
Right.
No question. I think you're absolutely right. He's continuing a lot of the neoconservative policies, especially this idea of regime change. He's not approaching it in the same way that President Bush did, for example, in Iraq, bringing democracy to Iraq. But he is supporting democratic revolutions in countries that we don't really, I don't know if we can really quantify that all of the countries where he's supporting democratic change have a majority of their population that are in favor of this. And again, what is this model that he's putting forward? How is that going to affect us in the long term? I mean, are we going to now walk around to every country with an authoritative regime that has a pocket of a democratic resistance and support them? I don't think that's sustainable for us.
Right. I think that he has been much less vocal about regime change, and his policies, although they have become more and more belligerent, it's just not as explicit as the Bush administration was. But I think that there are forces in Congress, for example, in the lobbying groups, that are just as adamant about having some kind of U.S. influence in the region and keeping a very close watch on the transitions that these countries will be undergoing.
Sure. And I hate to say it, but Barack Obama campaigning on the idea that he's going to shake up Washington, change Washington, it seems like the lobbyists and those powerful members of Congress that you just described have their hands in his pockets.
Well, let's bring Richard Reeves into the discussion. Reeves is a senior lecturer at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California, and is an author and syndicated columnist who has made a number of award-winning documentary films. Professor, great to have you on the program. Thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
We're discussing the recent Arab League resolution calling on Syria to scale back its military campaign against its own people protesting the Bashar al-Assad government. What can we expect from the Arab League resolution?
I think that particular piece of business is just talk. The Bashir is not going to change his ways because of the Arab League. He's going to continue to react to whatever is happening in the country, and I would imagine he's under great pressure. And the reason I say that, I realize why military dictatorships or authoritarian dictatorships resist falling. That you've got, I remember seeing in Burma, you've got the guys on top who started this, and in Assad's case, it was his father. But there are all these generals and colonels and businessmen and whatnot who are all part of it, and they're waiting for the old guys to leave so they can take over and get theirs. So that it's not just one man falling that changes a country. I mean, in Syria, the roots of power are very deep, and there are 28-year-old lieutenants there who are counting on getting a small estate or something out of their service to the Assads, and they're the ones who put pressure on the guy on top not to go to the French Riviera or back to London.
Can we talk a little bit about this guy on top? Who is Bashar al-Assad?
Well, he's an accident. His father was the head of the Air Force and was very smart, and seized power in 1970, I forgot, and died, 5 years ago? And held power despite one military defeat after another, particularly at the hands of Israel, but just maintained power the same way that I think Bashir will try to change power. Bashir was not the selected leader. His brother, who was killed in an accident, was, and he was an optometrist in London. That's what he was. And everybody thought when he came in, I guess it was 2000, everybody thought when he came in, the guy is a half-Westerner, and he knows business a little. He's going to open up things. Well, that didn't happen because it is. And what's happening now is, that the old axiom that revolutions don't begin when things are worst; they begin at the first openings of reform, when they suddenly realize there's a chance to get out from from under. But he, and the other thing about Assad and looking at the military history of Syria, he has an army of 200,000. But like many of these armies, they are not, and this is true too, say, of Pakistan, many of these armies are not designed to fight people. They're designed to control people. I mean, the Syrian army is like a high-tech, highly trained security police force. Their real enemy is the people of Syria, and that's what they know how to do.
Professor, the United States reiterated its stance calling for President Assad to step down. What do you think about the U.S. policy towards Syria?
I think that's as far as the president. Well, I think two things. That's about as far as the president can go right now, that we are we're stretched all over the world. But I have no doubt that we are involved in the one thing that Bashir must fear most. That is that we probably are quietly, I would be stunned if we're not quietly helping Turkey go after them. And Turkey, which is much bigger, much stronger, and could use some help from the U.S. too. So I think we are probably in there, but we can't invade another country. We just don't have enough people.
Right. And do you think we could characterize Obama's foreign policy as a continuation of Bush-era policies, especially given what we saw in Libya?
Well, it wasn't, you know, I mean, Bush had those policies, but he never used them effectively. I mean, he went into two wars and lost them both. But I think that it's partly an extension of the Bush foreign policy, particularly Afghanistan, that you know, Obama had been against the war in Iraq, so when he was running for president, he had to show he was tough. So it was Afghanistan he got tough on and continued the Bush policy there. But it didn't work for Bush, and it's certainly not going to work for Obama either.
AIPAC seems to have played a pretty prominent role in formulating U.S. foreign policy, and I'm wondering what you think about AIPAC's role in Obama's policy formulation.
I'm sure they played a prominent role. I mean, they're one of the most effective lobbies the country's ever seen. And also, you know, there is, I mean, these guys know how to play the game. There is a feeling that American Jews are moving to the right, and Obama can't let that happen. The financing of Democratic politics is largely Jewish, so they can, you know, they can let Netanyahu come around, promise to do things, and then do exactly the opposite the same day. They can try to humiliate us by announcing new settlements while Hillary Clinton is, I think Hillary Clinton it was, is in Tel Aviv. Yeah, they're a major factor in Obama's thinking, I'm sure. And I think Obama is totally committed to Israel. It's just that he, you know, because he, of where he came from and his mixed heritage, that people thought he was going to be more friendly toward Palestine. I'm sure he'd like to be, but AIPAC is one of the reasons he can't be.
So, Professor, what do you see for the future of U.S. involvement in Syria?
And maybe even the Middle East more broadly.
I think that we are, you know what I think we're doing? We're moving our bases around. We're going to keep our presence in that part of the world because of Israel and because of the oil, and this shakeup is going to mean that some bases are going to have to be moved, say from Iraq, say from Bahrain. We are going to stay there and watch as there are more and more Palestinians and the and Israel is forced into a two-state policy because it would become not an Israeli democracy, but an Arab democracy. And we're going to watch that process. We're going to help Israel as much as we can. We're going to try to maintain relationships with the Palestinians. The effect, again, AIPAC and other other American Jewish organizations. There's always been that saying that the American Congress is more pro-Israel than the Knesset. But that's what's going to happen. And then if one scenario would be for Syria to move outside its borders, because between Turkey and Israel, the only people they can beat at anything is Lebanon. And so they are there. I mean, he may think he's doing pretty good right now, but they're between a lot of rocks and hard places. But I don't think for 5 years Americans will take the field again. Maybe 5 years from now, and things that people have forgotten some things, there'd be a joint American-Israeli move on Syria if it hasn't changed by then. Hopefully it will have changed by then.
Professor Reeves, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks. It was fun, guys.
This is Eye on the Middle East, broadcast live from the USC Annenberg Graduate School of Journalism.
Please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Just search for Neon Tommy, Eye on the Middle East. Thank you so much, and stay tuned for next week's podcast. And of course, take care.